Hello, I'm Michael Armstrong. This is number 0377, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0377. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, military historian David O'Keefe. He's one of the producers of the World War II docudrama, Black Watch Snipers.
The idea was to focus on a particular group within the Black Watch, and we had an extraordinary discovery. There's only about 25 World War II Black Watch veterans left alive, but out of them, four of them were from what they call a sniper and scout platoon. They were snipers. And so we focused in on them, and when they sat down with us to tell us their story and their experiences, it turned out to be something that I would consider to be epic along those Band of Brothers lines.
And speaking of World War II, we have a retro interview from back in 2002 that I had with four World War II veterans of West Indian descent, talking about their experiences and why they joined Canada's fight in the war.
We were part of the empire. We were very loyal to Britain, as it were. And the doors to Britain, there were too many of us. And Canada was a Commonwealth country. And we had established very long, lengthy trade links and other links with Canada. So why not Canada? So a Canadian, Henry Collier, liaised with relevant departments and got an okay for us to come up if we passed a medical.
Photography expert Glenn Nielsen on cell phone cameras versus DSLRs.
The cameras in the cell phones have gotten tremendously better over the last few generations. If you're talking about social media, where your picture is probably going to be 2 or 3 inches square, something like that, the image that's going to come off of a cell phone is absolutely fine. If you're talking about, I want to take a picture of my family and I want to put it into a frame and I want to put it on the wall and it's going to be 2 feet by 3 feet, not with a cell phone.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you that this was show number 0377 was Mike Armstrong, an excellent, excellent news reporter for Global National. One of the best anywhere, really. Thank you very much for doing this guest slate, Mike. You do some truly amazing work. This is a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Apparently, they start them young in Texas. A 12-year-old boy was arrested on a charge of drunk driving after allegedly driving drunk and leading police on a high-speed chase. The boy, who was not identified, was charged with driving while intoxicated, failing to stop and render aid, and evading police. Austin police said the incident unfolded at around 7:30 a.m. A police officer noticed a vehicle was weaving in and out of traffic. The officer attempted to pull over the driver, but he sped up and led police on a high-speed chase. At some point, the driver hit another vehicle head-on. Surprisingly, the boy managed to drive away from that. Eventually, the boy hit a utility pole and the vehicle overturned, ending the chase. Police approached the vehicle, and it was then that they realized the age of the suspect and that he was drunk. He was taken to a hospital after suffering minor injuries. 12 years old and driving drunk at 7:30 a.m. So basically, he's an early drinker in more ways than one. And patrolling officers of the Guam Police Department spotted an unsafe motorcyclist on the highway. He was standing on the bike's seat and at least once raised his arms in the air. They tried to pull him over, but the biker led them on a chase, which ended when the biker hit a car parked in the median. Despite road rash, the biker then ran and had to be chased down and subdued with a stun gun. The biker, 25-year-old Manny Sablin Murciano Jr., had a backpack and police searched it, and inside they found two loaded guns, suspected drugs, a scale, and cash. and Murciano had a warrant out for his arrest in a previous felony drug case. He was, of course, arrested for that, and for multiple other charges. Okay, here's a tip for felons. When you don't want to attract the attention of the cops, try not to attract the attention of the cops. I mean, wow. Anyway, a British Airways pilot has been suspended after photos on Facebook show him with his pants down and performing sex acts while flying. 51-year-old Captain Colin Glover of Dublin, Ireland, has been suspended despite denying the allegations. Glover said that the person in the photos is not him. Now, one photo shows the pilot naked from the waist down. His legs are resting on the airplane's controls, and he appeared to be pleasuring himself. Because, you know, where else are you going to put your feet, right? The pilot is also wearing women's stockings. Another photo shows the pilot looking at photos of naked women while performing sex acts on himself. The photos of the naked women obstructing the view of the dashboard. Two different serial numbers are visible in the photos, suggesting that the images were taken on two separate flights. A spokesperson for British Airways said the allegations against Glover are extremely serious and therefore he was suspended pending the outcome of the investigation. You know, only one question remains. Where was the co-pilot during all of this? And this brings new meaning to the friendly skies. A little too friendly, actually. It also brings new meaning to the name of that little room that the pilots sit in. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a hairdresser was jailed after pleading guilty to practicing medicine without a license and causing a man to lose his manhood. 49-year-old Neri Carvajal Gonzalez, who worked as a hairdresser in Miami, Florida, was sentenced to 40 months in prison in a plea deal with prosecutors in which she agreed to testify against Mark Schreiber, who also worked as an unlicensed doctor. Gonzalez offered her customers body enhancement procedures. One man took her up on her offer as her prices were low. Well, you know, you get what you pay for. The man told police Gonzalez gave him butt injections and he was very happy with the results. He later returned to her for a penis enlargement. However, she botched the procedure. She then recommended that the victim should go to 61-year-old Schreiber, who police say lost his license 10 years ago over botched plastic surgeries. Schreiber told the man he would be removing the filler that was injected. However, he made things much worse after he mutilated the man's private parts, leaving it just 1 inch long. The victim is no longer able to have sex due to the botched procedure. You know, when you go to the hairdresser and you say a little off the top, this is not usually what's meant. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Military historian David O'Keefe is back on the program. He's one of the producers of the feature-length docudrama Black Watch Snipers. It can be seen on November 11th, Remembrance Day, on History Canada. David joins us on the line right now from Montreal. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. I've seen this film described as a sort of a Canadian version of Band of Brothers. Would that be a good analogy for this particular film? And Band of Brothers, of course, was excellent.
Yeah, I think so in microcosm. I mean, it certainly isn't an eight-part series. It's a, you know, a 90-minute one-off. But that was the idea. The idea was to go back and tell the story of one of Canada's most famous regiments, the Black Watch, from right here in Montreal, and their 10-month experience in 1944 and 45 during the Second World War. So the idea was to focus on a particular group within the Black Watch, and we had an extraordinary discovery. There's only about 25 World War II Black Watch veterans left alive, but out of them, four of them were from what they call the Sniper and Scout Platoon. They were snipers. And so we focused in on them. And when they sat down with us to tell us their story, their experiences, it turned out to be something that I would consider to be epic along those Band of Brothers lines.
Okay, so when you were first putting this together, when you first were doing the research to do this show, were you focusing on the Black Watch specifically or the snipers within the Black Watch specifically? Which one was it?
Well, it started off, we were taking a look at the experience of the battalion, the Black Watch battalion that went off to fight, and we started tearing down to figure out who was still around, who we could interview. And then when we realized that we had a very unique story, because unlike the riflemen who fought in the rifle companies, these standard combat soldiers that you would normally see, these guys lived in their own world. They operated on their own rules, basically. They were always behind enemy lines or in front of the battalion. They were the eyes, the ears, the flies on the wall when the decisions were made. So they really had this incredibly unique story. So we ended up refocusing our energies on them.
Now, you're a historian, you're a military historian, so you know your stuff. Yet, in doing the research for this, what was an aha moment for you? What did you discover that you weren't aware of, even with all your knowledge?
Well, I think every time you take a look at soldiers in battle, I think there's always a different dynamic that comes out. And although I was expecting some sort of dynamic, I wasn't really expecting this kind of dynamic. I mean, we centered around the four soldiers that we interviewed. But what came out of that was their undying love and respect for one of their other brothers within the sniper platoon. He was an older soldier by the name of Dale Sharp. He actually was the old man of the scout and sniper platoon at the age of 26.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that there was actually a guy that you could call in the platoon a sharpshooter?
Yes, actually. Yes,
wow.
Unintended.
Wow.
Yeah, he was definitely called a sharpshooter. But the amazing part was, here he was married, couple of kids, and like everybody else in World War II in Canada, the vast majority of them were just citizens who became soldiers overnight and were thrown in to one of the ultimate professions, if you will. None of these guys were professional soldiers before the war started, but they all came together. But the four of them, their entire experience centered around their interaction with Dale Sharp. And so that was the amazing dynamic that came out of it. These four guys who were teenagers, they were all between 18 and I think the oldest might have been 21, and then there was Dale at 26. And so they really leaned on him as friend, as mentor, as brother, as father, anything you could think of along those lines. And so that was the real aha moment, if you will.
In talking collectively to the four, I mean, they're old men, but did you get a sense of the type of character they had collectively? Some sort of trait that when you talk to them, you can say, well, yeah, I understand why they did what they did.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the interesting thing that I think the viewer is going to notice is even 70 years later, when they are talking to the camera and to the viewer at home, you see the same personalities that were there at the time. And at the end of the documentary, we actually reunite three out of four of them together. And it's almost like they became teenagers again, because their interactions were defined by 1944 and 45. So for them, they've never left that when they see each other. I mean, they've all gone on, had successful careers and lives and grandchildren and whatever else. You put them together, and they're teenagers again. And I think that was the amazing part about doing this. And then, of course, you know, one of them, Jimmy Wilkinson, who was the best shot out of them all, he was the actual sharpshooter. My brilliant director, Robin Bricknell, decided she was going to take them 70 years later to a shooting range in Ontario and give them their same Lee Enfield 303 rifle and let them shoot. Now, Jim Wilkinson was known, I think unfairly now, as a bit of a braggart. And every time you would hear a story coming out of Jimmy's mouth, it was, I was the best shot, I was this, I was this. And you were like, yeah, sure, Jim, no problem. Well, 70 years later, he hadn't touched a 303. And when they gave it to him, in quick succession, he put an entire grouping together, which is exactly what you want to do as a sharpshooter, at about 300 yards distance. I hadn't touched the rifle in 70 years. So suddenly you realize that personality was, sure enough, still kicking 70 years later. And from now on, it was like, okay, Jim, whatever you say, I may just believe it a bit more now.
You know, and again, you're a military historian. You know your stuff. You never really, if you spend any time with anybody who's ever been in the military, you never really lose that sense of awe as to what these men and women did, especially in times of war. And when you also think about how young they were, do you keep getting that sense every time you talk to these guys?
Yeah, I do. See, the thing is, you got to put it in the context. I mean, how many 18 and 19-year-olds are put into a situation like these guys were? And, I mean, I teach at Mariopolis College, so my students are that age. So when I see them, I cannot picture them going through the kind of harrowing ordeal that these guys went through. I mean, you know, with the Black Watch, they took the most casualties of any Canadian regiment during the war, and these guys were on the sharp end of it all. So, you know, they really do bear the scars. And even 70 years later, when you talk to them, that was their moment. That was their bonding. Some of us have college. Some of us have sports teams. Not for these guys. This defined them as teenagers and young men.
I mentioned in the beginning Band of Brothers. A lot of American kids, at least through things like Band of Brothers, are aware of what their military did during World War II. And there are a lot of films out there as well. You have done this show, Black Watch Snipers, this docudrama. It gives Canadians a chance to see what Canadian military officers and infantrymen did during World War II. Do you find doing this that it's an uphill battle, especially as a history teacher? It's an uphill battle to get people to realize we have an amazing military history of our own.
Oh, do we ever? I don't know if it's an uphill battle. I think uphill in the sense that we don't really tap into it as much as we do. But when we do it, it's extremely popular. I mean, that's one thing that it's a vein that perhaps we really haven't tapped as well as we should. And there's a wonderment about it. There's a high emotional content to it. And the reaction is incredible when they realize, my God, you know, the stuff we've seen on Band of Brothers or Saving Private Ryan also affected affected Canadians as well. You mean Canadians were doing this? But of course, the answer is yes. And now you get a chance to sit back and see some of their stories. But again, it's one of the best untapped veins that we have in Canada is our Canadian military history legacy.
The docudrama is called Black Watch Snipers. It will be on the air November 11th, Remembrance Day, on History. For those who might not have a chance to see it on that day, will it be repeated, and will people be able to also buy a copy of it on DVD, for instance?
Yes, it will be repeated on a regular basis on History Television over the couple of weeks after Remembrance Day. But also, if they want to see it, they can go to history.ca, because History Television, after it actually runs for the first time on television, they do upload all their programming to their website, so people can check it out there if they don't have a chance to catch it when it airs.
Excellent. Always great work, David. Always great to talk to you as well. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Oh, thanks, Pete. Anytime.
Military historian David O'Keefe. Black Watch Snipers airs in Canada on History on November 11th. Check your local listings for the schedule.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about cell phone cameras versus DSLRs. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. Stick around for that. And more Stuff File news on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But we don't have more Stuff File news right here, because I'm going to continue in the same vein of our last guest before the break, since Remembrance Day is coming up. Friday, November 11th in Canada is Remembrance Day. It's Veterans Day in the United States. Remembrance Day commemorates and honors the brave soldiers who lost their lives in military campaigns. Here in Canada, many nationalities served in the armed forces. Back in 2002, on a television show I used to host here in Montreal called Soul Call, I chatted with several members of the Canadian forces who were of West Indian backgrounds. There was a soft spot for me with these gentlemen. My own uncle was among their numbers. I invited into studio four veterans: Owen Rowe, Vince Cadogan, Burt Wharton, and Leo Rivera. We started the segment with Owen Rowe, who recited a poem that he wrote back in the day.
When we think of Remembrance Day, we often think of that poem in Flanders Field, which is a very, very important poem.
Of course.
But we're looking at it from a West Indian perspective this week, and I thought we'd start off by hearing a poem that you wrote.
Okay.
So will you share, what is it called?
It's called Soldier's Farewell, and it wrote itself. So powerful, powerful were my emotions that the words came out, and these were the words.
Okay.
Land of my birth, O dearest earth, beneath whose shining skies I toil, I must now leave thy sacred soil and risk my blood on foreign lands to save thee from the harsh demands which tyrants heartless would impose if none to freedom's call arose. I go with warm tears in my eyes, for I shall miss thy smiling skies, the rapture of thy myriad stars, those festive nights with soft guitars, my love, and all that I hold dear, which just in dreams can now be near. Land of my birth, so filled with mirth, I go, and I may not return, but fires of my love shall burn for thee, bright as thy noonday sun, sure as a victory to be won.
And you wrote that back in 1942, was it?
May the 13th, 1942. It wrote itself.
It's very powerful stuff.
Thank you.
And I would assume it brings out the sentiments of others.
It epitomizes the driving force between all of us coming up.
One would ask, I mean, it's a very noble thing, but one would ask, you know, why come to a foreign land to, in essence, be part of somebody else's military to fight somebody else's war?
Okay, but you see, we were part of the empire. We were very loyal to Britain, as it were, and the doors to Britain, there were too many of us, and Canada was a Commonwealth country, and we had established very long, lengthy trade links and other links with Canada, so why not Canada? So a Canadian, whose picture you will see later on, Henry Collier, liaised with the relevant departments and got an okay for us to come up, if we passed the medical.
Yeah, he's saying,
and
Mr. Collier.
There's the man, yes.
H.C.
Collier, who was Secretary of the Canada West Indian League and editor of the Canada West Indies magazine. And he liaised with the Canadian military here and with a branch in the West Indies and got permission for us to come up there, provided that we passed the medical when we arrived here.
And it should be noted for our younger viewers that, of course, you mentioned being part of the empire. Most of the Caribbean countries that are now independent were, of course, still part of Britain before. They were not independent at the time of the war.
That's right. They were actually colonies. They were actually colonies at that time.
Now, tell us about your own story when you came out of Barbados, basically.
Yeah.
And became part of the Canadian military.
Okay, but I was a school teacher in Barbados, and my father, who missed out going and being involved in World War I because he was too young, and he always regretted that, and he thought that in going also it would also make him very happy and very proud. Well, what you see there is now, I had an athletic, they allowed me to do athletics too, and I won a lightweight boxing championship of the military establishment. I knocked out an American, I think, when I won that cup, lightweight championship of the of the Edmonton military establishment.
Taking a chance to damage that pretty face?
I was very quick with my reflexes were very, very keen. That explains. So this guy asked for it. He was open. I just whacked him.
Now, years later, of course, as we do in this program right now, dealing with Remembrance Day, a lot is being done to remember those who have fallen, unfortunately,
in the previous
wars. And here's a picture with you. This was, I believe, with
Senator
Ann Coles.
She happens to be a Barbadian, you know. She's in the Canadian Senate. And she walked up with me as I laid the wreath at the cenotaph in the millennium year. And the Ukrainian Legion must be thanked for giving us that permission. So they endorsed the role which we West Indians played in World War II.
When you first came out from Barbados to train here, there's a natural fear and apprehension coming out and just going to new land. But not only are you going to new land, you're going to war.
Yes, going to war.
What did that feel like?
Of course, we were so imbued with patriotic zeal, you know, and the German submarines were shelling the ships in the sea lanes, and so we were really pretty keen to get out there and put these people in their place, you know. So that overrode all the other considerations, you know. It was a very rigorous trip across from Barbados, first to Halifax, to Parkington, New York, and so on, you know.
By sea?
By sea, yes. Mm-hmm. And then by rail to Montreal, and then we enlisted.
The picture you're seeing right now is of Sergeant Graham Nurse. This is the one fellow that we had invited into the program, but unfortunately he's a little under the weather, so he couldn't be with us this week. But Owen, tell us a little bit about Sergeant Graham Nurse.
Sergeant Graham Nurse was born in Barbados. In 1916, I think it was, he spent eight years in the volunteer service there and the national service. Came here to Canada, enlisted in 1941. He took his training in Three Rivers, where he became a specialist in the Sten gun, the Bren gun, the Vickers, and other guns. And then, when he was about to go overseas, they said, hey, this man is too precious to let him go overseas. Let's keep him, let him train officers here. And that's what he did at Three Rivers for a long time.
And we should point out, which is very important, that he didn't actually go to war, but he did have a very important role.
And vital role.
A vital role in training others who did go, and that's just as important as those who went.
Because it's a team effort. The war of winning was a team effort.
And we're sorry that he can't be with us on the program this week, but we wish you well.
Thank you very much.
We do have another person here with us in studio, this gentleman, and his name is Leo Riviera, and Leo is a Canadian Merchant Navy man. We welcome you to studio. How are you, sir?
Oh, holding on to life.
Thanks for coming in and being on the program with us. Now, you originally came out from Barbados as well.
Out from Barbados.
What is your story in being part of Canada's military? And I see you're well decorated as well.
Yes. I joined a Canadian merchant ship around 1936 because sailing was my love.
Oh, okay.
In 1941, I was on board the Canadian ship Lady Hawkins, which was torpedoed on the 19th of January.
Now, we don't have an actual ship, a picture of the ship.
1942.
Okay.
Lady Hawkins was an identical ship of this design. This is the sister ship.
This is the Lady Nelson?
Yeah.
Okay. So a similar ship to this was torpedoed.
Yeah, the Lady Hawkins. On the 19th of January, 1942, German submarine struck two torpedoes in the fore part of the ship, and approximately in 20 minutes, she turned on her port side and shot forward and sunk. I was fortunate to be in a lifeboat with 76 people. Six died in the lifeboat, including my brother, Austin Rivera. And it was at that moment that I became very concerned as to the future. We spent 5 days adrift in the lifeboat. We were picked up on the fifth night on a passenger ship called the Coamo, bound for Puerto Rico. We arrived at Puerto Rico, and I was pretty well knocked out, delirious, and I am sure that I would have passed out that night.
It must have been a terrifying situation, especially considering you lost your own flesh and blood, your own brother, in that same situation. At what point, you were out there 5 days.
5 days.
When did your brother die?
He died the second night from exposure, because it was the 19th of January. It was pretty cold. We didn't have any clothes or so on, and we had to stay, most of us. There were 11 West Indian boys in the lifeboat. One died, the other five, some were Canadians and some were Americans.
And you buried the men at sea?
Yes, we put them over at sea. The chief officer's name was Captain Kelly. He said, bring him up. He said, put him over. I assisted in putting him over. We had a missionary lady by the name of Mrs. Parkinson. She lost her husband when they jumped, and she survived. And she said a prayer, and they raised a little hymn. At that point then, I started to cry. I had another brother, older brother, Orville, and he told me to cheer up. So we went into Puerto Rico, and I was taken to the School of Tropical Medicine, delirious and frostbite. And I spent some time there. When I came out, I stayed in a hotel. Then an American transport ship decided to take me. Well, we went to St. Lucia.
Right. So back to the
not
Caribbean.
Not going back to Barbados. But while at St. Lucia, they were about to transfer me to the Lady Nelson to go on to Barbados. And that's when a German submarine came into St. Lucia Harbor and sunk the Lady Nelson.
Now, you mentioned you lost one brother.
Yeah.
You mentioned an older brother?
Yeah.
Were you all in the military?
Three of us. In the Merchant Navy.
Three of you?
On the ship.
How well did this go over with your family, three boys all going off to war?
Well, we didn't consider this as going to war. It was a way of living for years in Barbados, sailing in ships. Barbadians are noted seafarers. And most of us were on those ships sailing even before the war started.
Now, the ship we showed, the one we showed in the picture, and I'll hold it up again, this was, if I'm not mistaken, a...
This here is the Lady Nelson. After she was sunk in St. Lucia, she was taken out, repaired, and she became Canada's hospital ship. She brought home many of the war brides.
And was this one of the only hospital ships?
That I know of. Canada, you didn't have a lot of merchant ships left around then.
And it brought over war brides, which is another fascinating part of the war, because the women who came out marrying men who were in the military, another very interesting aspect. When you think of the sacrifices, primarily that you personally suffered, you know, 5 days out at sea, losing your brother the way you did, you look back on the situation and the whole concept of war. What are your thoughts? Was the effort worth it? Is it an important fight to
Well, fight? I always felt that bravery is displayed through ignorance. That was my opinion. Mm-hmm. But as far as seagoing is concerned, I learned that the sea has given more to man than it has taken from him.
Interesting sentiments indeed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating story. I thank you for being on the program with us, Leo.
I'm happy to be here.
That was Leo Rivera from Barbados, who survived 5 harrowing days at sea in a lifeboat after the ship he was on was sunk by the Germans. He also lost one of his brothers in the same incident. Later in that same Soul Call show, we continued to talk to Owen Rowe, and we were joined by Vince Cadogan and Bert Wharton. We started off with Bert sharing the story of how he ended up in the military.
After I left high school, I had a job working at the government laboratory. Uh-huh. And my brother worked there, so I went there to work there after I left school. It wasn't a very exciting job, so when the opportunity came up for me to join the Canadian Forces, I volunteered, and that was it. Okay. I was accepted, and I came up here with Owen Rowe and your uncle.
Wilbert Holder?
That's right. And 36 other chaps. And I was the youngest of the group.
Any apprehension in becoming part of this and leaving home and going to a foreign country and then fighting a war in a foreign land?
No apprehension. The only really unfortunate aspect of the whole thing, prior to my going overseas, I was asked to stay on guard duty in Farnham because I was in the infantry. And there was a detachment going overseas at that time. And every time there's a detachment being prepared to go overseas, the people who are scheduled to go are are kept in a special barracks, and you have to stand on guard in case they change your mind and decide to go go AWOL. So I was on duty that night, and was in January, and the temperature was about 30 below zero.
Ooh.
And for 2 hours, I stood out there, and I cried like a baby. Yeah. It was so cold.
Mm.
And that's one of the worst experiences I've had since I left home.
And coming from a warm climate, too, not even used to the concept of 30 degrees below.
That's true.
What about your story, Vince?
Well, my story, I was in the Barbados Volunteer Force in Barbados. And when this Canada asked for volunteers, I understood, from Barbados, I volunteered. I just volunteered because...
Why?
Well, I was already a soldier, and... soldier was in my blood, and I wanted to go. So I volunteered and hoped that I would pass the medical. So I passed the medical in Barbados, and then I was holding my breath that I would pass it up when I got up here. And I got up here, and I passed it up here, and I was a soldier from then on.
Now, it was a different world when you gentlemen joined and became part of the military. First of all, there weren't a lot of blacks in the military. And what was that experience like in dealing with others you had to deal with?
Well, unfortunately, in my specific case, as I said before, there were 38 of us who came up in that specific contingent. And the majority of us were stationed at Huntingdon for our
basic
training. And we were all together in the same unit, so to speak. So. It didn't feel too strange because we had 35 or 36 other brothers, mm-hmm. quote unquote, to play with, talk with, and discuss old times.
We should also mention at this point that not all the members who came out from the Caribbean were black.
Yes.
And there were others who came out who were part of the military who are of a white background. There are whites who live in the Caribbean, 20%. Mm-hmm. And they came out as well, including this gentleman, I believe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman is who, Owen?
His name is Neville Murray of Trinidad. And he had the distinction of being a squadron leader in the Royal Canadian Air Force and also of being awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, which was presented to him by King George V.
I think we have that picture.
That's a picture of, there's King George V, His Majesty, pinning the medal, Distinguished Flying Cross, on squadron leader Neville Murray of Trinidad.
So there were a lot of people who were also decorated. We noticed some medals when we were talking to Leo a little while. We noticed some medals on you, Vince. Tell us about the medals that are on you right there.
The medals there are the Canadian Volunteer Medal, and the France, Germany, Britain Medal.
Now, you gentlemen had an opportunity to come back. Some people did not come back, as we were talking to Leo about his brother.
Correct.
Some people were also captured.
That's right.
Now, who is this gentleman
that
here?
That man, his name is William Rodriguez, and he came from St. Kitts in the Caribbean. And shortly after he completed his training in Canada, he was sent to Hong Kong. And lo and behold, the Japanese invaded Hong Kong, and he was captured. And for the duration of the year, he was absolutely treated horribly. He became like a skeleton when he returned to Canada. William Rodriguez.
Okay. Now, how many members of the military came from the West Indies?
About 350 came up here.
Mostly from which islands?
All the islands. Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, Antigua, Dominica, etc. The distinction of this gentleman here, his name is Leslie Brown of Jamaica, is this. He was the very first one from the Caribbean who enlisted in the Canadian Army. He was on the Canadian Merchant Navy, Lady Summers. He heard about the war. Canada declared war on September the 10th, 1939. He booked off the ship in Montreal the very next day and enlisted in the Canadian Army. Leslie Brown of Jamaica.
Do you guys get to hang out at all? I mean, the war was many, many years ago, and I've got to say this. I know you mentioned earlier, Owen, that there are not a lot of you left, but you guys look, you're in great shape. I mean, I think it's hard to believe that the war was 60 years ago.
Well, sometimes that man I look at myself, I am amazed. And I'm still alive, much less look as well as I do.
That's right. That's right.
No, we used to hang out together initially back in the late 40s, 50s. We used to have reunions and whatnot. And it's only in recent years, of course, that there's so few of us that we have an organization called the West Indian, I think.
Veterans Association, which I started.
And there are not too many of us left. There are only about six or seven of us left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the contingent in which I came up, total 38. Mm-hmm. And of the 38, I'm sure there are only about six of us left.
Correct.
We're just almost out of time, but I do have to ask you very quickly, what important message do you want to say to the youth who have no idea about what you guys went through and what you did
for
this country?
We would like to say that certainly with me, what I am today was honed by the discipline that was instilled in me during my training in the war.
And I understand that they're going to commemorate the work that you guys did as part of the Caribbean with a plaque.
Yes, the Canadian War Museum, they are going to have a plaque to honor us for all time.
I thank you, gentlemen, for being in studio with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And thank you for all that you've done.
That was just part of several segments I did on the television show Soul Call back in 2002, talking to four vets of West Indian origin. They were Owen Rowe, Vince Cadogan, Burt Worden, and Leo Rivera. Of course, time continues to take a toll on the numbers of these brave soldiers. On this Remembrance Day, 2016, only one of the group of over 40 men remains. That's Burt Worden. If you would like to see the entire set of interviews, along with the pictures we showed, you can see the segments edited together on my YouTube page. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0377, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a simple way to get rid of all the frivolous lawsuits we hear about in the news? For example, when a blind man is walking through a mall with the help of his seeing eye dog and accidentally steps on a woman's foot and then is sued by that woman, and yes, that's a real lawsuit, shouldn't there be an easy way for a judge to throw that case out? Believe it or not, there is a way. The lawyer representing a victim of a frivolous lawsuit simply has to ask the judge to dismiss it. Whether the judge does that is another matter, but the point is, judges must be asked first. Let's be fair, you'd think every lawyer who's hired to defend someone from a frivolous lawsuit would do that, but not so. Several judges have told me over the years that too many lawyers simply don't ask them to dismiss frivolous lawsuits. Now, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but if someone ever files a frivolous case against you, make sure your lawyer's first move is to have that case dismissed. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
Still to come on the program, we'll talk about DSLR cameras. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Vermont State Police say the tractor-trailer rollover that happened on I-89 Wednesday morning was caused by a drunk driver that was changing his pants in the truck cab during the crash. According to police, 62-year-old Alan R. Johnson of Meridian, Connecticut, was driving north on I-89 at 63 miles per hour while standing in between the two front cab seats when the truck rolled over. Police say Johnson took a preliminary breath test and had a blood alcohol reading that was five times over the legal limit for someone driving a commercial motor vehicle. The rollover caused traffic issues for several hours. You know, alcohol and drugs removes people from making it onto the idiot of the day list, but you have to admit, drunk or not, that is pretty high up on the moron scale, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Smartphone cameras are super convenient, but are they the best choice for taking pictures? In a pinch, they can be a great option, but for some of the milestones and more memorable moments in life, a handheld camera may be the best option. On the line with us right now is photographic expert Glenn Nielsen. He's the author of Photobomb: Take Your Family Photos from Ordinary to Outstanding. He joins us on the line from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. Before we get started, I want to actually mention the title of your book, Photobomb, Take Your Family Photos from Ordinary to Outstanding. It sounds like you want to put yourself out of work, Glenn.
No, actually, I don't. Because it's very apropos for your discussion today, because the first part of that book talks about some of the limitations of a cell phone and reasons why, if you understand those limitations, you can get a better picture. Not that I'm trying to make anybody a professional photographer or anything. I'm trying to get people to understand what they're doing that's making the picture turn out less than what they wanted.
Okay, so we hear all the commercials and the advertisements, and we see the group sessions when they launch a new phone, especially the fine folks at Apple. When they launch a new phone, people always talk about, this does this better than it used to, and this does that mm-hmm. better than it used to, and they always talk about right. how much better the camera is. So how much better has the camera gotten over the last little while? And does it compare to a handheld camera in any way, shape, or form?
Well, the cameras in the cell phones have gotten tremendously better over the last few generations. If you're talking about social media, where your picture is probably going to be 2 or 3 inches square, something like that, the image that's going to come off of a cell phone is absolutely fine. If you're talking about, I want to take a picture of my family and I want to put it into a frame and I want to put it on the wall and it's going to be 2 feet by 3 feet, not with a cell phone. Mm.
And I'm of a generation, I grew up in the 60s and always a camera fan since those days. I guess it's all relative, because back in the day, you had your Kodak Brownie or whatever it was, you took your pictures, and then you sent off the film to be developed, and you waited for those 24 shots to come back, and if you were lucky,
right.
half of them were stellar, and some of them were blurry. So I guess from the advantage of that situation is, you can see instantly whether you've got a decent picture or not with a cell phone, and the quality of the cell phone picture certainly outshines the pictures I took when I was a kid.
Right. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, film can give you an absolutely unbelievable quality if you're using good film with small pixels and all that. Probably even better than digital, but digital is really just so convenient and everybody's got it, and film has become inconvenient. So the comparison really boils down to, what do you want to do with your image? And if you're talking cell phone photography, you must remember that that sensor that's taking that picture, that's holding that information that makes that picture, is probably smaller than your thumbnail. And if you're talking about a DSLR, certainly a professional level DSLR, you're talking about an image that's about an inch by maybe 5/8 of an inch or 3/4 of an inch. So it's significantly larger, which means it has more pixels, it has more information in each of those pixels that are on the picture, and the pixels themselves are larger.
Now, there are those who are going to swear by their cell phone cameras, and, you know, if that's what they want, that's fine. And then there are those who, like myself, I like a traditional DSLR camera. But in the middle, right. In between those two groups, there's, I guess, what we call the compact camera, like a Coolpix or something like that, smaller
yeah.
than a DSLR, but more powerful to a certain degree to a cell phone camera. Are those cameras, the ones in the middle, are they in danger of evaporating from the face of the earth?
Well, there's always going to be somebody that wants, you know, that area of photography. But I would say, if you're talking about long range, they're probably going to have to do something different, because, you know, the cell phones are really getting to the point to where they're as good as that type of a camera. And there's really no advantage, because you don't have the capability of changing lenses. You may or may not be able to put a flash on it. You know, so it's pretty limited in what you can do. And the cell phone is just so convenient because you stick it in your pocket and it's always with you.
So is there going to be a time, as you say, the cell phone cameras are getting better and better. For your from your experience, do you see them reaching a point where they are more competitive with a higher grade camera than they are right now, or are they always going to be inferior?
Again, it depends on what your purpose of taking the picture is. If you're doing it for social media, I would say they're probably already there. If you're talking about making a print, something you can touch and hold and show to your friends, no, they're not there. I'm not convinced that they will ever get there, because you have to remember that the technology with the DSLR is also advancing at the same time that the technology for the cell phone is advancing.
And that brings up an interesting point too, because, you know, I only got my DSLR camera about 6 years ago. Before that, I was a film guy, and, you know, I had my trusty Nikon FM. So I jumped on the bandwagon late. Are the cameras getting better and better? Even the DSLRs, are they getting better and better than they were just a few short years ago?
Oh, absolutely. They're getting better every year. You look at the major manufacturers, you know, like Nikon and Canon, they each are producing a new camera about once a year that has significant improvement over the previous generation.
Now, was that something the camera companies always did, the rush to improvement? Was that something they always did in the past, or are they doing it now because they're worried about the cell phones creeping up behind them?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how much they improved every year in the past. I know they keep coming out with new features and whatnot in the cameras. But when you're talking film, I mean, film is film, and it can only get as good as the film and the lens that's in front of the film. So you could improve the lens, but your camera really isn't going to change that much. When you get to digital, now you're talking about electronics. You're talking about little tiny dots that can carry either a little bit of information or a lot of information. And the more information that's there, the more you can work with your image. You can manipulate it. You can change the color temperature. You can change the focus. There's all kinds of things that you can do if you have enough information on that pixel.
Mm. What camera do you use?
I'm a Nikon user.
Ah. A man after my own heart.
So I have several. I have a D3X, I have a D750, and I have a D800.
And if you were to recommend a smartphone, which one would you recommend? Mm-hmm. Which one would you recommend?
I would have to honestly say that probably the difference between a phone camera is probably more in the eyes of the beholder than it is in the actual technology. It depends on what you want.
Depends on what you want. Okay. Do you have a smartphone camera?
I do. I have an iPhone.
And what do you, as someone who is a photographer, for instance, and a professional photographer who is always carrying cameras around, I'm sure, what do you use your smartphone camera for, if at all?
I use it very rarely, but I'm probably a little bit in the minority there, because I think most professional photographers actually do use their cell phones, one for the convenience, and two for the fact that if you're not trying to do professional work, you know, you're just showing your friends what you're doing, it's perfectly acceptable.
Mm. So bottom line, smartphone cameras are here to stay, but they're not necessarily pushing compact cameras out of the way completely, correct?
Correct. I would say, you know, there's going to be a need for professional level cameras. There's going to be a need for professional photographers, regardless how good the cell phones get.
Even though you're trying to put yourself out of work with your book, again, your book is Photobomb.
Well, no, I'm actually trying to educate people, because an educated user is a better user for me.
Good point.
They understand that I understand what's going on, then they're going to be more likely to ask me to do the job that they don't want to take the time to learn how to do it right.
Excellent point. The book is called Photobomb: Take Your Family Photos from Ordinary to Outstanding. It's written by Glenn Nielsen. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is tampabeginnings.com. There's some really nice pictures there, by the way. I just thought I'd throw that in. Thank you very much, Glenn, for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for inviting me. I have really enjoyed it.
Photo expert Glenn Nielsen, author of Photobomb: Take Your Family Photos from Ordinary to Outstanding. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0377, and you'll find links to Glenn's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A man stole a police car and live-streamed as he drove the car with lights and sirens. The Oklahoma man was able to take the car when a police officer left her keys in the unlocked cruiser during a coffee break. 25-year-old John Pinney got into the police vehicle and drove off. He led police on a 30-minute chase. During the pursuit, Pinney recorded four separate live Facebook videos. At one point, he said that he was driving with his knees so that he could record the videos for his Facebook friends. He also stopped the police car and got out to record the surroundings before speeding off again. Police said that Pinney reached a speed of 120 miles per hour during the pursuit. He eventually decided to stop at his parents' house, where he was arrested. Pinney, who has a long criminal history, was charged with auto theft, possession of a firearm, and eluding police. After the arrest, the police sergeant said that he would encourage every criminal out there to live stream their crime so that they can be caught and so that the video can be shown at their trial for a better chance of conviction. Because, you know, why? Oh, why? Would you post Facebook live video of you stealing a police car? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0377. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0377. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.